At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Positively Trek. My name is Barry. With me, as always, is Mr. Dan. How you doing, Dan?
Not too bad. Excited, very excited to talk about this episode.
Yeah, I think when we hit stop on viewing this, you and I both had a moment of silence. And that doesn't usually happen between the two of us. Usually, we're constantly chattering with each other. And yeah, there was like a good beat of like, huh, wow. So I think the reasoning behind this is a lot of things are done right. And the episode we're talking about, of course, is The Sellout Who Ate Its Tail. Now, that's an interesting play on, you know, when we were initially talking about this episode, and of course, as Dan mentioned in the last episode, spoilers, huge spoilers, we're talking about everything. Please watch this before you listen to us yak about it. Please watch this for yourself, because this episode can't be unwatched. It is in the best way, right? It's to have, you know, even if you watch the trailers and stuff like that, I think enough is kept to give you some pretty cool concepts and thoughts and topics and themes and stuff to chew on at the end of all this. And the I guess the human or English speaking idiom that is closest is the, you know, a dog chasing cars, right?
The dog that caught the car, yeah.
Yeah, you're the dog that caught the car, right? You don't know what to do with it once you've finally gotten it. Yeah. And in so many ways, this episode rolls over that concept. Off the hob, the opening sort of teaser before the credits, we've got Jim Kirk. He's a first officer, and he's already eyeing that chair, right? His Vulcan captain is, you know, just so boring, right? And everything, you know, he wants to beam down, and he wants to do all the Jim Kirk-y things that he's going to get to do in a couple of years, and we're going to see him do it in the original series. Wow. And TV studio willing, we may see Paul Wesley doing this again sometime too, which I would be 100% for. I have some thoughts on Mr. Wesley's whole play here, but we'll get to that in a second. So, you know, all the things he wants to get at, literally blow up in his face. I love where he said, they're like, what's happening, right? The planet they're going to beam down on suddenly just kind of shatters apart. And he just looks up and he's like, it's that. Man, was that good. That opening was some good fun, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. But let's...
Yeah, sorry,
No, that's awesome. But I do want to talk about Jim Kirk as the first officer here as well, because it occurred to me after we watched it, the dialogue is almost exactly the same. This is an inverse. It's a complete inverse of Archer and T'Pol, and I didn't realize it, where
Holy crap. They
go to a new planet and Archer is like, let's send down a landing party. Let's explore everything. And and T'Pol says, there are several protocols. We should send down unmanned probes. We should do this, 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 and this. And Archer's like, no, that's ridiculous. This totally flips that. The captain is the one doing the surveys from orbit and stuff. And it's the first officer Kirk that's like, we should beam down. We should beam down. She's like, no, that's not Starfleet protocol. That's we need to do all these things and do this by the book.
But that's an extremely good point. I never even thought about that.
I didn't think about it until afterwards. And I was like, oh, some of that dialogue is actually almost exactly the same, but inverted.
Huh. I hadn't even considered thinking about the Archer to Paul inverse look at that, but that's exactly, man, your Star Trek shower thoughts are out of this world.
Well, to be fair, I think it's the writers. They're so good about picking out this stuff. Like between the Voyager holodeck thing from a few episodes ago and then this, I'm like, yeah.
And brilliant. I think that's what we like about this is, again, the love letter continues, mm-hmm. right? The love letter to the fans, and they're not being explicit with these references. If you don't catch the reference, you're not going to be out to lunch. Like yours truly, I didn't catch that reference. But now that you say it, I'm like, oh, wow, that makes perfect sense. But even someone who may have never seen Enterprise yet, they can still enjoy this scene, but they're going to get the treat later when they finally get to Enterprise. so, no, you're right. This there's a lot of, I guess that's it, is I'm going to call the writers very considerate, aren't they? They're very considerate.
I think so.
Super considerate. But yes, I think that Kirk as first officer, right? It's the he's getting summit sickness. Mm-hmm. It happens on Everest a lot. People climbing the mountain will risk their lives stupidly to get to the top of the mountain when really taking a break, slowing down is actually the better choice. And I think, he gets the payoff pretty fast, but or not, I guess not the payoff, the results of his ambition. But I think just writing him in as they have so far, these little dips that we're getting with Jim Kirk over and over again. And this episode, I think, is a really fun and interesting culmination of those dips that we've been getting of him. This is how you do an origin story right, mm-hmm. of an already established character, right? We have origin stories of non-established characters. That happens all the time. But
yeah.
Jim Kirk arguably is the most important long-standing kind of person you think about next to Spock in Star Trek. And we're getting his origin story done, I think, correctly here as well. Ethan Peck starts in Discovery, and he's made it all the way here now. But I think Paul Wesley is taking these elements of Bill Shatner, I would even say to some extent Chris Pine, and he is building this character well. He's getting, like, there's little flashes of Shatner's Kirk coming in, but at the same time he's evolving in a nice, slow, well-paced way. Movie origin stories are typically, you know, they're done to death at this point. We don't need any more of those, please. But they're often very rushed, right? I mean, as much as 2009 Trek was fun, if you go back and actually watch that, Kirk's origin story is very rushed. It's done like a carnival ride. Whereas this one, you know, there's a lot of investment. I feel very invested in Wesley's Kirk.
Yeah, a lot of what the writers are doing here is like you say, doing an origin story right. Like, I would love to sit and compare the work that they've done with Paul Wesley's Kirk to, as much as I think this movie is unfairly criticized, I think there's some very good criticisms of it. Alden Ehrenreich's take on Han Solo in Solo, which, you know, was a fun movie. I don't think it's as bad as people give it credit for, but it takes the tack of this kind of a collector version of a character origin story. Where did he get his gun? Ooh, where did he get the little dice on the Millennium Falcon? How did the Millennium Falcon end up looking like that? Like, it's just, it becomes a quest to acquire all the things to be the thing, right? Whereas, you know, in some ways this is too, but it's more acquiring characteristics. There's another podcast I listen to all about science fiction and fantasy called Realms Unknown. Mm-hmm. And Alice Fraser is the host of that. And she makes a very good point about how to do character origins correctly. What you do is you take a character that you know and love, and you put them at a point where you're like, how could they possibly become that character that I love? They've done something reprehensible or something, you know, totally opposite of what we expect of them because they're not that person yet. And then you show that evolution to becoming that person. And that's kind of what they're doing with Kirk here. He's not doing anything reprehensible, but he's not the seasoned commander yet. He's the overeager person who's trying to attain this goal without really thinking through what that means and what those responsibilities are. Mm-hmm. And then by the time this episode is done, like, this is his trial by fire. This is his getting smacked upside the head and realizing, oh, this is what command is. This is what it's all about. And these are the kind of people that I need around me to make me be an effective commander.
Yeah.
I love that. It's not like, I don't know what an equivalent would be, but it's not like they're just, you know, have him assemble all the things to make his costume like what it is in later, whatever.
Oh, I have the analogy. In both cases, we're seeing a cake, right? And there's the Kirk cake and there's the Han Solo cake. And let's face it, they're very similar in terms of their ingredients and both swashbuckling and blah, 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 right? With the Han Solo movie, we got a completed cake that got some icing on it.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas in Strange New Worlds, they're making the cake. They're putting in the ingredients. You're watching the eggs crack and go in. Yeah. And they're mixing these things together. He is being developed from the inside out, whereas Han Solo got a bunch of trinkets and accoutrements and accessories to make him who he is, right? And that's, I think, the biggest criticism of Solo is it's kind of shallow in its development. And I think it's because it was rushed. It was packaged, as Ian Malcolm from Jurassic Park would say, put on a plastic lunchbox and they're selling it. They're just selling it, right? I don't think we're being sold Captain Kirk here. I think we are getting a deep dive into why Jim Kirk acts the way he does and why mm-hmm. he chooses the people he chooses. And, you know, there are aspects of him. Like I said, he's a bit of a jerk. And that's not going to change. He's still going to have those jerky qualities about him, right? And I mean, he's going to convince people later by saying risk is our business, right? But he'll also admonish crew members for being rash and brash and stupid later, right? He's going to have all of those dynamic aspects baked into him. And I think mm-hmm. that's it, is we're getting a really lovely Captain Kirk cake out of this.
Yeah. And if you're not going to do that story, then why do it, right? Like, I would question the reason. The writers, I feel like, I don't know them, I don't know their process, but I feel like they're coming at it from an angle of, like, if we're going to have Kirk in this, if we're going to have an endpoint where the Enterprise gets turned over to Kirk, like, why have him in this show? He could just show up at the end and be the guy that comes. No, we have interesting stories we want to tell. We want to show these people at a point where they're not who we know them as yet. We have a reason to do this story. I would contend, and maybe this is unfair, but I don't think it is, the reason they did a Han Solo movie is to make some money with a popular character. Like, it wasn't, there was no creative impetus behind doing that movie. There was not somebody that said, I have a great idea for what made Han Solo who he is. Let's write that story. Yeah. It was, we love this character. Let's do a prequel thing.
Yeah. And that's it. I would agree that Star Wars does actually learn its lesson and goes, hey, I've got a great idea on how the Death Star plans are found.
Yes.
Right? Absolutely. Andor was an absolute masterpiece.
Absolutely.
But I think what we're building here with Strange New Worlds is also a Star Trek masterpiece. Because at this point, if we really think about it, if you were Robert April, who's the first person you're going to think about to captain the Enterprise after Pike is gone?
Yeah.
Like, in a actually, like, practical, like, let's just look at all of, like, follow the trail of rice. They are writing Jim Kirk in as the suitable, and it, like, no magic has to happen. It's not the 25 minutes of doing something heroic. No, like, you can just look at his record and be like, oh yeah, no, this guy is 100% the guy we want. Mm-hmm. And I think it is. He's sort of building a resume, and we're watching it happen too. So, yeah. And I mean, I think the same thing is happening for Spock in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of things are happening with Scotty. I just think they really turned Kirk up to 11 on this episode. Speaking of things that get turned up to 11, those visual effects.
My God. Oh my God. that continuous shot that just, the more happened in that shot, more and more, and I was just like, wow. So the scavenger ship, this massive ship, has pummeled the Farragut, and it's you know, half wrecked, tumbling away. The Enterprise warps in mm-hmm. and, you know, fires some debris out of the way of the Farragut. That's when this big ship shows up and then launches things at the Farragut. The Enterprise pulls in front, takes the hits on the shields.
It's got a skeleton, like, head.
Oh God. Everything was, I was so amazed by it. Like, if I'd have seen that on the big screen in a movie, I'd have been like, these are incredible cinematic effects. The fact that this is a television show blows my mind.
Yeah, it actually kind of it strikes me similarly to the shaky lens flary approach of the Narada in 2009 Trek, right? Of this like just impossibly gargantuan sort of, I don't know, octopus cetacean like evil entity ship thing doing terrible stuff. But yeah, this the visual effects, I think at one point I did turn, we were in your living room watching it on your television, I turned to you and began screaming at you that you needed a bigger TV. Because yeah, like I want to see this again and I would love to see it on a big screen. This man. Episode's what visual eye candy. I mean, the people who are doing these effects must be having an absolute blast. And I mean, pun intended there. They set it up well. And I think that's the thing is, you know, jumping from the bridge of either the Farragut or the Enterprise back and forth, seeing what's happening outside of the ships as all effects and then inside of the ships, my suspension of disbelief is gone.
Yeah.
It's completely gone. I did not think like, oh, cool effect, and now they're back on set. I was in that scene, right?
Yeah.
It was only when you paused it that I was like, Dad, you need a bigger television. But yeah, I mean, and you already have a lovely sized one. I shouldn't badmouth your television choices. That television is perfectly fine. I don't have one. So I should be one to talk. But the way the Farragut takes damage as well, the physics of things hitting it and stuff like that, and then watching how the camera moves. Yeah, it's kind of almost, it's got that ride aspect to it that I really, really enjoyed. That was fun. And actually watching when the planet, you just see the planet, the whole side of it just opening up, basically. Yeah. Absolutely petrifying.
Yeah.
Like, ugh.
And the character work in that moment, too, where you see the look on Kirk's face and you know what he's thinking. Mm-hmm. And it gets reinforced later in the episode where he was like, I was pushing for us to be on the surface of that planet. Mm-hmm. And like, there's no warning. The planet erupts.
Yeah.
That seemingly innocuous decision would have mm-hmm. killed them all. Like, yep. Wow.
Right then and there, that'd have been it. So yeah, we're getting everything converging here, right? We've got some interesting characters who we've known for a while. Like we've known Jim for seasons now. This is great to have him around, right? Paul Wesley is not learning how to be Kirk. He is Kirk. He has mm-hmm. everything he needs. Now we're just kind of baking the character at this point. Watching the character work as it stands, as I've mentioned, and then having extremely strong visual effects is something that really takes a person into this story. And I think that's where, right off the hop, we haven't even gotten past the opening crawl yet, right? We're still talking about just how this whole show starts, this whole episode starts. You know, I mean, I think about Babylon 5. The effects did not hold up. They have not held up. Excellent, mm-hmm. excellent series. The acting is fantastic. The costuming is fantastic. The visual effects are from a Commodore 64. So, you know, do with that as you will. In this case, though, my goodness, right? We've got everything we need, and those visual effects are beautiful. Chapel, Scotty, Uhura, and Spock wind up on the, I would say, somewhat Cerritos-reminiscent Farragut. Doesn't it kind of look like the Cerritos a little bit?
Oh, I guess so. I mean, kind of Reliant-esque with the nacelles underneath, yeah.
But it's just the saucer with the nacelles. It didn't have a secondary hull, did it?
Yeah, the Cerritos does. The Reliant doesn't. So I suppose, that's yeah. why okay. I feel like it's a little bit more Reliant-esque. But
a Relitos.
Yeah.
Or a Seriant.
Yeah. But maybe similar in mission profile. I don't know if they handle the kind of...
Fair. Fair.
Not as premier missions as the Enterprise, maybe.
Yeah. But yes, Chapel, Scotty, Uhura, and Spock beam in and plot armor their way into being the people that Kirk has to work with. And I thought it was interesting that immediately you said, like, this explains why Jim Kirk is going to select these people as his bridge crew, right? They're them working together. And I mean, through this episode, and we can kind of work through that in a second here, but them working together to come up with solutions and eventually, you know, through a series of no-win scenarios, manage to win. Yeah, I mean, you're right. As you'd mentioned that, Dan, this is where Kirk starts, you know, getting to take some notes on who he's going to want to have on his bridge crew.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's clear that, like, you know, these people got him through this trial by fire, right? Like, we see a lot of Kirkisms, things that he's going to take into his career as a captain, but they're not refined yet.
Yeah.
Like, there's the moment where Scotty's like, if we push the engines too hard, you know, they're going to implode and it's, you know, it's not going to end well. And Kirk says, Scotty, I trust you. Push them to maximum. We can do it. I have faith in you. I have faith in the ship. Mm-hmm. We've seen that later, but it's tempered by experience. It's tempered mm-hmm. by knowing when and how and where to push. Yeah. Here, he's just pushing. He's just kind of slapping buttons to see what works. And yeah. like, he's gonna figure it out. It's gonna happen. Everything's worked out in his life so far. So right? why wouldn't this, right? And he gets that splash of cold water in his face when the engines give out and they're dead in the water. And Scotty's like, I told you. Mm-hmm. And Kirk's like, oh, I didn't realize that, like, you were serious.
Yeah. Well, and each character approaches Kirk in ways that you're right. They will approach, right? Spock is very supportive.
Yeah.
More so than he is even of Pike. Mm-hmm. I just found him very like, yep, he's the captain. We listen to him now. Right. Which Spock will actually later do a really good job of being supportive in a more critical way for Kirk. Right. The one interesting aspect that I do appreciate is in his current, like, you know, baby bird form, not fully baked cake, Captain Kirk. I like how it is sort of subtly brought up that actually a captain who acts like Captain Kirk without the refinement, they go to mutiny adjacent talk pretty fast. Yeah. They're like, we need to get this guy off the bridge. We need to get this guy out of here because he's kind of a prick and he doesn't know what he's doing, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas later, he's kind of a prick, but he really knows what he's doing, right? Yeah. And so I really appreciate that, you know, had Kirk not learned all his lessons, he would have probably been mutinied pretty fast. And I like that was sort of just slid in there kind of nicely.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I felt that was very realistic, too, yeah. because they're frightened, and yeah. they think the wrong person is in charge, this inexperienced lieutenant commander.
This flyboy.
Yeah, and like, even the people that have worked with him, Uhura speaks up for him, says, mm-hmm. I've worked with him in crisis situations. I think he can get us through this, but she's also like, you know, not putting down their idea of like, if we have to, you know, if he isn't the right person for this job, like maybe they would all feel better if Spock was in charge or somebody else. Right.
Yeah.
But, I do like the scene where, you know, it is off-putting where he kind of leaves the bridge and he's like, I can't take all the nattering, leave me alone. I need
crashes
to think.
Out.
Yeah. But then when he comes back and reassures them all and says, like, I want to hear options. I need to hear this and all of this. And I do have a plan for getting us through this and I'm not going to give up and blah, blah, blah. And I love Scotty. He's like, thank you, sir. I needed to hear that.
That was a good one. And such I think
a good line.
Yeah. And that kind of real moment, which is, I think, why Scotty in future iterations, I guess, past future iterations is able to be like, he's so real with him. Right. He's mm-hmm. Scotty and Bones especially really give Kirk whatever's on their mind because they know they'll be heard.
Yeah.
And for Kirk to acknowledge Scotty in that sense, I think this is a game where we're going to start seeing Scotty be able to exercise that confidence he doesn't fully have yet, to have a guy like Jim Kirk say, I trust you, but also I believe you is the other piece that Scotty needed to hear, because yeah, like you're right. He said, no, you'll get it. Blah, blah, blah. Like, no, believe what he's saying. He's not joshing you. Right. Scotty knows what he's talking about. Yeah. I think also Spock's pep talk. I noticed that Spock chose words. He doesn't say the word illogical. When I think he would have normally, he says like bad or something else,
yeah. right?
Something different that I know. I think he knows how to reach Jim. And, you know, Jim's literally on his knees playing a game of chess And you could see he's really in this completely defeated. He's gone to this sort of infantile tantrum state, mm-hmm. right? And Spock big brothers him out of that a little bit. And I appreciate that quite a bit, because that's what ultimately turns him around. And I think it's from Uhura advocating for him that Spock realizes the direction that he needs to take. So again, they're already acting like a bridge crew. They've already got those little elements, right? They're not being decorated with it, right? He's not saying, I can't do it, Captain. I don't have the power. And Spock isn't saying illogical. And Uhura doesn't have a thing sticking out of her ear. And she's turning around and saying, Captain, blah, 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 right? They're human beings interacting with each other like human beings. And it makes it a very, there's a lot of texture in this piece, in this scene. And yeah, the Farragut limps its way through space in a pretty cool way.
Yeah, I do like, so the plan is an interesting one too, because there's this planet that's directly in the sights of this predator, and they want to try and rescue the Enterprise. And what they're going to do is get ahead of it to this planet and all of this stuff. And they do get ahead of it, but the engines stall out, like Scotty says. They're now just massive paperweights. That's all they are. They're good for, until Kirk puts them to another use later, which was great.
I can't wait to talk about that later. That was an interesting turn of events.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk about that. I have stuff to say too, but, and I love that, like, it's gone from, like, we've got a bit of hope to this is the absolute worst case scenario. We're now in the path of this thing and we have no power and all of this stuff, right? So no wonder they talk about mutiny a little bit. This is bad.
Yeah. One thing that I think is interesting, though, is they know their enemy and they don't. Mm-hmm. Because they say they're scavengers, they're ruthless, they take whatever they want, and they'll go for the easiest thing they can get. What's easier, a planet or a ship, right? And using the ship as bait to be that, like, that mineral that they're going to kind of use exhaust for to make
Aldentium?
Aldentium, I don't know. That seems like that something on
some pasta thing. I don't know.
I was like, is that some kind of tooth component? I don't know. Al Dante. I love their tech speak, but basically the idea that we know that this race is ruthless, we know that they always want more, and they're going to get what they can get fast, right? So we are going to make ourselves look as attractive as possible. Knowing your enemy is the battle in a lot of ways, right? I like how that gets turned on its head shortly. But I think, again, it's a practical and it's a believable way to wriggle out of what is clearly a no-win scenario, right? We're dead in the water. We're stuck, blah, blah, blah. What are we going to do, right? And so I think they do manage to find a reasonable and suitable way of figuring this out.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
As always, Positively Trek is brought to you by its Patreon supporters, including Joyce Mirren, Brandy Jackala, Christina DeClercq-Zalagi, John Guppy, Out of Memory, Patrick Carlin, and Ricky Long. If you'd like to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can join at any level and enjoy early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, episode shoutouts, executive producer credits, and more. Again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you so much to those of you supporting us. We truly do appreciate it. And now, back to the show.
Now, here's the thing. There's a whole other ship in this episode that we haven't said a single word about. So the Enterprise gets
the hero ship
gets gobbled up, gobbled up by this like Skeletor in space kind of ship. You know what? At first I was a little like, okay, the Skullhead's a little much. Later, I'm like, the Skullhead is not a little much. The Skullhead is exactly what it is. These are pirates. And we'll get into that a little more later too. I like the Skullhead. I like the choice of, of how it even consumes stuff. It goes hop and it eats it. And this sort of harkens back to a lot of stuff I am burying the lead on. So I will stop there.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Enterprise and the Farragut. When the Enterprise is first gobbled up, I was totally thinking Doomsday Machine, right? Mm. With Kirk trapped on the battered Constellation, watching his ship attack the Doomsday Machine and all that kind of stuff. And it was just the visuals in that moment were very evocative of that. And I think that's, again, just the genius of the creators of this show, just twinging little memories of Star Trek. And I think that was a really good one to evoke here. Because when that planet first blew up and Kirk said, "Oh my God, it's that thing," I was like, is this going to be the planet killer? Like, that's the only thing I could think of that was, like, we just saw a planet get killed, right?
Yeah.
But thankfully they didn't. This is a totally new and interesting direction, and a very interesting direction, as you say, that, like, we learn at the end. But still just plucking those guitar strings of our memory to evoke those images. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't get the lethal destructive space bugle. And I mean, like, the little bugle you can hear. That's what I think the Doomsday Machine looks like. So the Enterprise gets swallowed up, but it's not destroyed or anything immediately, right? It's literally going to get harvested for parts by these beings. And so you've got Pike and his bridge crew, most of them, now basically trying to figure out what's happening, right? The noxious gas is being pumped into certain parts of the hull. All of its power is being completely sapped out of it. Comms are down. Really, we have, again, something of a no-win scenario, right? Like, the Enterprise is literally in a full-on chokehold. And I like, even, again, some of the more practical aspects where Pike is like, get everyone away from the outer hull. It's gonna get real cold there real fast. And that's true, right? Space is a very cold place when there's no sun, and if there is, then it's a very hot place. There's no in between. So I do appreciate those little details that make this feel like, oh, they're actually on a spaceship. The only thing is, they should have probably been floating around at that point.
Yeah, but we saw the backlash when they did up Number One's hair like that the first time. If they did that again, I feel like there would have been a mutiny.
Yeah, but, fair enough.
Yeah, zero G.
They should have been floating.
So expensive, but yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Well, maybe the inside of the ship that swallowed it has its gravity too. So, and it looked as though that the Enterprise was upright. There, I just saved the episode.
Perfect.
You're welcome, Paramount.
There you go. Yeah, I love this. The tactically superior vessel is the one that's completely immobilized by this thing, and it's up to the plucky underdogs to save them, which I like stories that have a setup like that. I really enjoy that sort of David versus Goliath kind of thing. The Enterprise, of course, completely without power, getting invaded by these mysterious, huge, suited
Bioshock kind of
things. And then when you get up close, maybe those helmets look a little familiar. I don't know.
Big diving bells almost, right?
Yeah, like or big NASA helmets with the spotlights on the side. Something like that.
Something like that. I appreciate the kind of it's all just business kind of behavior as well, right? Like, until they point guns at the creature that's currently working his like the proboscis that they've sort of stuck into the Enterprise, he's pretty unconcerned by that.
Yeah.
He seems very unconcerned. And then once it's noted he's a threat, then his companion opens fire with a very primitive style weapon. And the yelp that crew member makes, I found very, I don't know, I didn't like it. It really bothered me. She sounded hurt.
Yeah.
Like, gugh.
Definitely. Adding to the confusion of the scene, which is interesting too, is our characters are in environmental suits with full helmets, right? And for once, they don't do the weird thing in sci-fi, which is whenever somebody's wearing a helmet, they have lights in it that shine in their face and eyes, basically so we can see their face, but that would make it impossible for them to see anything.
Right.
They actually had the darkened face, and I think part of that was to be like, was that Lon that just got shot or was that someone else? I remember when we were watching, there was a little bit of like, was that Lon? Who got shot? What's going on? Yeah. And then you hear Lon's voice and you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. I don't think it was, but you still don't know for sure.
Turns out that was all intentional too. Interestingly, again, I feel like the buildup and the payoff are great. And we'll, mm-hmm. we'll get to that here. But so, you know, this fight takes place. It looks as though these creatures have some kind of aspect of their suit that's able to absorb or at least deaden the shock of these weapons. And then we do see later when Lon and they do find some like Home Alone style tactics. I don't know what was in that that alcohol bottle, but boy, did it burn yeah. when they set that trap up in the mess hall there for those two individuals. They see yeah. the bottle roll and they shoot it and blows up. Also, that when Pike tells Lon, set phasers to kill, right? There's a beat between them where it's like, okay, we don't have an option. We can't stun these people, whatever they are, right? Yeah. We have to kill them, right? They're not going to stop. We have to kill them. And I think that's again, more of that buildup, right? And the haste and speed at which they get into a physical altercation with them, right? Pike is bashing the one and Lon is, you know, hitting the other one and she manages to turn off its absorbing machine thing. I don't know what else to call it. And then just turns, bam, shoots it. Boom, gone. Mm-hmm. And then when Pike is fighting, that thing catches his shield or whatever he's using and manages to overpower him and knock his face mask off. And he starts choking on the noxious gas. And it gets his gun. How did yeah. you feel when it points and it doesn't shoot him? Because he brings it up later.
Yeah, that was interesting. And it was kind of like is there some recognition there? What's going on? Are his gloves just too big to... No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. But there was definitely obviously something there for sure.
Yeah, I felt very much at that exact moment that there had to be some kind of familiarity. Right. Mm-hmm. And part of me was wondering if there was maybe this character who's pointing Pike's gun at Pike, maybe it knew him, right? Maybe that we were going to get some kind of character who an alien species that has already encountered Pike, and maybe Pike showed some kind of mercy or some kind of positivity towards it. Again, the buildup is interesting here because I think this is where we get our first real hint as to what exactly we're dealing with. And again, I like the fact that Lon doesn't waste a second. She just starts like lighting that thing up, shooting it over and over again as it starts walking away, which again is quite interesting. This lumbering tank of a beast kind of getting away as it's getting shot over and over again with a phaser that's set to kill, right? You think about mm-hmm. the power that those phasers have. They disintegrate whatever they hit on sight. So he's definitely hurt in a pretty bad way moving forward. Yeah. But back with the rest of the crew, right? I think we've really looked at Pike and Lon at this point. Systems are down. How are we going to manage to communicate with each other? Well, it's Pelia to the rescue, isn't it?
Yeah. Apparently, she's got a trunk full of telephones in her room. She's the ultimate hoarder. Which we saw last season. They made mention of her storage unit and transporting it up and all this stuff. But boy, she really has everything in there. An Atari. Like, that was fun to see.
Right?
I piloted a starship like this once. It was 8-bit, but it was a great Friday night or something, whatever she says.
Well, I also find it funny that did she watch Space Adventure Show? Frontier?
Yeah.
Yeah, did she watch The Last Frontier when she was a kid or something? Like, I don't know. Like, I'm just sort of thinking like she would have grown up in a universe technically without Star Trek, right? Because mm-hmm. she's in Star Trek, so she can't watch Star Trek because that would be kind of meta and weird. But I do appreciate that kind of turnaround. The other bit, though, is that her quarters are a very dangerous place. I feel yes. like basically everything in there could become missiles whenever the Enterprise gets rocked by something in battle, right? Like, I just feel like she would come back to, like, just crap everywhere.
Yeah. You
know, like, just things shattered and broken. I also like how she had the cat clock. And she was like, this thing was really whimsical and fun until it became less stylish and it just became super creepy.
I love, yeah, your point about the stuff in her quarters just being thrown about during a battle. There's a moment in that scene with the alcohol bottle in the bar as well, where they're hunkered down and, you know, the hulking alien, as far as we know, is trying to beat his way in and smashing at the door, mm-hmm. and it's shaking the room, which is causing the little glass things on the ceiling to fall and chatter around them. And I'm like, those didn't fall during the like wild shaking and buckling of the ship when it was getting captured earlier, or any other time. It seemed weird. I mean, I get it's to ratchet up the tension in the scene, but like, if they fall because somebody's banging on the wall, I don't think they would have survived anything else we've seen in this episode.
Not even close. And again, that sort of definitely harkens me back to the deleted scene. I think it's in Nemesis. It might be in First Contact, where Picard is, they're workshopping this like automatic seatbelt system. Oh,
yeah. It's Nemesis. Yeah.
Yeah. It's Nemesis. And I just think to myself, like, I feel like the Enterprise should like be the Batmobile from 1989 Batman. And like when Red Alert happens internally rather than externally on the Batmobile, it like things shut, doors shut, things get pinned to walls and everything else. Right. Like, because you're right. Like, there's a lot of breakable stuff on that ship that really should be broken a lot and like create massive hazards. Like I'm reminded of that episode of The Expanse where Amos and another character are stuck in the cargo hold while they're doing a high G set of like burns.
Oh, yeah.
And like, there's just things flying around and they're dodging while they're also getting pulled from place to place and stuff. And yeah, I felt like that was explored a little bit better in this respect, and rather than just sort of used as a way to increase the tension. But
yeah,
I digress in that respect. So Pelia's idea, she pulls out this box of phones, and she's got phones from, you know, like an Art Deco phone, and she's got like one from the 80s, one from the 50s, and they start running wire, because you can't jam wire, you can only cut it, and you know, that's a whole thing. So they actually use 19th to 21st century technology to outsmart these beings, which again buries the lead.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I was thinking about that. But like, if anything, if I was one of those creatures and I came across it, I'd be like, oh, I know what that is. Right.
Maybe. I mean, they're several generations removed.
But their
ancestors certainly would. Yeah.
I'm sure they'd have some of those things on the ship. Something similar, at least, right? Some redundancies and whatever else. Yeah. They'd have USB keys and you know, Ethernet cables, I'm sure.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. So they basically use what should be familiar technology against them, because their heads are so in the clouds, I guess you could say. We'll get into that in a bit. But Pelia is an interesting character here, because, again, she comes in handy. She knows what to do, right? Mm-hmm. Much like with Gamble, shoot him. Just shoot him. she knows that, you know what? If the modern stuff doesn't work, well, maybe sometimes the older things can still be good. And I think I have an argument, like I teach social studies, history and stuff like that. And I think sometimes we cartoonify our historical predecessors, but to understand that they had a living to keep and they had ways to survive, and they did, because we're here and they survived, right? Like, we're not, you know, we are kind of looking down the barrel of some pretty existential crises in our society right now, environmentally, in terms of the way we handle disease and disease care, the way our economy is currently happening, the fact that we've got some pretty awful conflicts taking place as well. There's a lot of culminating events that I think they're actually a cause from a lot of our behavior in the past, but, you know, maybe there are some solutions from the past that we can look at as well. And I think Pelia does a really good job of bringing that up, of like, sometimes we need to be open to the way things were previously done to fix the way things are now as well. Right. And I'll get into that later.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the outside the box thinking, the use of novel ways of doing things. Like, that's a hallmark of being in Starfleet too, right? But that unique perspective that she brings with her extremely advanced age, which also comes into effect when we find out who the aggressors are as well. Her knowledge is firsthand. This isn't something that you look up in a computer. It occurs to me, you know, Federation starships have like a historian officer and stuff. Like, why aren't they actively recruiting Lanthanites for those roles?
I feel like they fit the job description pretty well. Right? What were you doing?
It was a Sunday, if I recall. But yeah, I love her perspective in this. And like you say, similar to the last episode, she brings a weight to this that, like, she was there. She saw firsthand what led to this happening, right? It puts it in an interesting perspective because to her, it's not... It's one continuous thing. Like you say, we look at a past with a certain lens that, like, that was then, this is now. And there's kind of not a lot of relation between the two. There's these facts and historical things that we learn, but this is the world we're dealing with now. For her, it's a continuum. It's the world she has been dealing with for her whole life. I remember in season two where she said, like, she has a whole bunch of stuff stashed away in case this socialist utopia thing doesn't work out. Like, that's just the way the world is now to the folks in Strange New Worlds. To her, it's just the next thing. We'll see. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. I don't know.
No, it's a fascinating, she brings such a fascinating take that I have really appreciated. So we managed to get the Farragut back. It uses its nacelles themselves to short out this big ship, which I think was a really fascinating way to knock it out, right? Using its greed against it, which ultimately I think, you know, is the pinnacle of cosmic justice, right? Is when you can use something's greed and conceit against it, right? Really rub it in its face, right? And then we have, you know, how are we going to defeat this ship? It's got its mouth wide open. We can see the Enterprise. Enterprise is managing to get free. Ortegas is literally got Mbega and Una piloting each nacelle as they're going, moving forward through the ship, and the RCS thrusters, and they're literally on the phone telling each other what to do. And then you said, Isaac Newton would be,
he's in the driver's seat when Una has, like, the thruster controls stop working, so she blasts open an airlock, to use the explosive decompression to simulate a thruster, basically.
Yeah, I love that. The science and the tech. It kind of reminds me of when the Enterprise loses power in Enemy Mine, and Picard uses, like, the gravitational pull of a planet or something.
Booby trap. Yeah.
Oh, booby trap, not Enemy Mine. You're right. Yeah, there we are. Of booby trap to get out using the science of space technology to get them out. I thought that was pretty fun. And then Spock has a great idea on how those tentacles are going to get stopped. He knows where he can shoot this ship to destroy it. And he does. And everyone cheers. And you even might see a little smile or some, a little flash of satisfaction pass over Spock's face. Mm-hmm. And it was all a big setup, wasn't it, Dan?
Yeah. Like, I remember watching that scene going, like, I'm glad they've escaped, but, like, there's probably a lot of people on that ship. Like, the fact that Scotty has jumped out of his chair and whooped and put his fist in the air, I'm like, whew, I don't know if I could cheer at that much loss of life, regardless of how, you know, aggressive they were and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is definitely loading the emotional pathos on one side so that you can release it in a shotgun blast later with the revelation we get, right?
Yeah. And they look into that, the little view scope, and they see people, Dan. They see human beings. They don't see humanoid beings. They see actual human light. Well, no longer life signs. 7,000 dead human beings. And again, Pelia comes in handy. This was during the 21st century after World War III. The nations that are left behind managed to cobble together a generational ship that is going to go out into space and try to keep the human race going, because at that point, human beings weren't terribly sure if they were going to make it. I felt heard and I felt seen. We are in some existential crises right now. We are in a lot of danger. Interstellar tackled this as well. For Pelia to say, I remember this, and give her, you know, actual personal take, you know, it does kind of make you be like, well, how did these, and she said, these were the best of us. Right. And now this group of people, human beings, are on a ship that they've clearly spent centuries hybridizing into, I would say, a terminal seeking behavior. That you know, human beings, we're hunter-gatherers by our nature. We like to seek. Many of our disorders are based on our seeking behavior, right? Gambling, shopaholics, doom scrolling on the internet, and other internet-based addictions, if you catch my drift. Certain personality disorders come from seeking behavior, and the fact that we typically aren't satisfied by it. That's why consumerism is so powerful, right? I would say that this society on this ship got caught in a bad spiral, but they're still people. And that revelation, especially the conversation between Kirk and Pike, when Kirk is just absolutely broken up by the fact that he has killed so many people, that something like that gets covered in Orson Scott Card's book, Ender's Game, where Ender is fighting what he thinks is a simulation, but actually no, he's genociding the entire alien race that the human beings are fighting. And that feeling of realizing that he has just ended something so incredibly, another sentient group of beings is by and large the tragedy in itself, right? So with that, I think Kirk's revelation, you know, is something outside of his control, because, you know, he didn't know. But now that he does, he probably would have acted differently. Maybe he would have stayed his hand, like the human didn't shoot Pike. But this does maybe ask some larger questions of how do we get into these, you know, terminal states of acquisition and destruction and dehumanization. So dehumanization, I think, is ultimately the piece, the thing that gets us.
The Saylot got its tail, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can't really add much to what you said there for sure. That summarized the feelings that I had watching this perfectly. I will say, like, putting it in the larger context of Star Trek history, the amount of crap that we've sent out there that keeps coming back at us, right? V'ger, Khan and his augments aboard the Botany Bay, which are still out there waiting to be discovered at some point. Friendship One in Voyager, and like all of these things that this is just one more thing. I'm actually really reminded of a story that takes place in the novels, which is this colony on an asteroid that they've parked in one of the Lagrange points of Earth. World War III breaks out and they're kind of cut off from Earth. And then there's some sort of warp experiment that opens a rift and they get shunted out to the Large Magellanic Cloud. And they were the O'Neill habitats. And then centuries later, when I think it's Sulu and the Excelsior encounter them, they've become the Nihil. Like they don't remember Earth. They're a totally different alien race. And they've, you know, engaged in genetic modification and stuff to adapt to their environments and stuff. Right. So this is a very similar story to that, where we don't recognize the human, they're aliens, until it's literally like thrown in our face, right? And that moment where they detected 7,000 life signs aboard the ship and they give the fatality report at the end, and it's approximately 7,000. There's not one single survivor. They have killed them all. And I mean, there's a lot of feelings that go on in that, and I hadn't even considered it, but you know, Pike says, they saw us, they saw who we were, and it, you know, for one of them, it stayed their hand briefly, but they either didn't recognize us or they didn't care. So it's not all on us. It was them too, but it's still so sobering.
I think we can look at this, and I'm not going to say that this is what the writers are trying to say, but this is an analog that I can draw from. And the idea of true evil is a lack of empathy, right? We think about one of the worst genocides in human history, right? The Holocaust, in Europe, where European Jews were killed, along with Gypsies, Romani, Slavs, disabled people, all for the sake of being considered not human, Untermenschen, right? Literally, literally
LGBT
not.
LGBT people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the fact that the people killing them were convinced of that, and they did kind of shut them off, right? Like, you know, going to the gas chambers, you just drop the Zyklon B in and ride on your bike to the next thing, right? And I think, you know, closing off, you know, having an unrecognizable ship in these uniforms that completely hide exactly who you are. I mean, there's a similar kind of like adjacentness that you create, right? To dehumanize the person you're scavenging, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing opposite for how they're, you know, the Enterprise and Farragut crew are dealing with this menace as well. Now you have in West Asia, the arguably generational, children of the victims of that genocide, now themselves committing a genocide that is as bad, just not seen as far. It's only 2 years in, whereas you know, we know that the Holocaust was several years in the making and then put forward. And again, the same separations, right? Soldiers aren't going in terribly as much, killing people. These are Hellfire missiles being fired from distance, drones flying in at distance and killing people. To some degree, you know, you look at what happened to these folks to make them this way. And I mean, there's a lot in history that we can talk about on why things are happening in West Asia. There's good in us, there's bad in us. I'm not trying to say specifically this is a religion or an ethnic group. I'm saying that this is a group of people who have lost their way and who are now no longer leading with empathy. And, you know, the arguments of, well, that, you know, something must have happened to them. Maybe they were wronged. You know, we can talk about the October 7th attacks, but at this point, over 100,000 people are dead. Many children are dying a day in Palestine. A famine is taking place now, and it has no sign of stopping. And I think this is it, is we do have examples in our society now where we can see people losing their empathy and dehumanizing people. And that's where I think ultimately this episode, as much as it's a fantastic look at how Kirk is developing, how these crew members are coming together, the special effects that are just absolute eye candy. Even the horrifying shots of bodies floating in space, I can't unsee that, Dan. That was really hard to watch. Like spoiler, but also like content warning, folks. If somehow you've gotten this far in the episode and you haven't seen this episode, and you
question your life choices for sure.
But also like, that was hard. I don't like seeing dead people. It really sucks. Yeah. Even if they're fake CGI ones, that was very realistic. Great storytelling, character development. Fantastic special effects that are eye candy and fun to watch. Cool sciencey bits using Isaac, you know, Newtonian physics to get them out, blah, 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 blah. And then this absolutely hard-hitting message about why we must empathize, why we must show empathy, that in states of conflict, we need to be good to each other. So I think with that, I'm going to end. And maybe, Darren, you and I can talk about this episode again at some point, because I do think it bears more bears more exploration, especially here. But maybe we can do that in other ways and in other times. This episode was a masterpiece. If you have something to say, if you want to talk more about the way the episode worked for you, what stood out, character beats versus ripped from the headlines versus cool special effects, feel free to pop into our Facebook discussion. You'll notice I'm there a lot more, and I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the conversations, folks. So with that, we hope you enjoyed this episode, and we hope you enjoyed that episode. And always, stay positive.
Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
See you out there. This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.